I'd like to thank first Ricky and all of you for allowing me to come and preach in this beautiful space this morning. Before I came here, I spent the past month, most of the month of May and the first part of June, in Ireland, leading a group of Nebraska students on a study abroad course where we studied the coming of Christianity into Ireland. Did you know that Ireland is famed as the only country in which no missionary died while bringing the faith to the people? I mean violently, of course, because they all died eventually, but you get the idea. Oddly enough, as pagans, the Irish warmly welcomed the faith, and they took to it comparatively quickly, without prolonged arguments about matters of doctrine and what the ruling class got out of it and all that sort of thing. And you know, it just didn't happen that place anywhere else. Then for century upon century, the Irish remained Catholic. When the Protestant Reformation came in the form of the English, so the new form of the faith really never had a chance. Even when the English worked hard to obliterate the Catholic ideals and customs, the people remained stubbornly, placidly, for the most part, Catholic. The opening decades of the 20th century found institutional Catholic Christianity weakening across Europe, as decades of warfare and atheistic ideologies caused so many to cease to be able to balance the old faith with the new reality. Not in Ireland, though. In fact, as the Republic defined itself as a new Irish nation, it was with and through the strong support of the church. Irish schoolchildren learned that the bishops and the archbishops had as important a role to play in civic life as the Parliament and the Garda. If you were raised in Ireland as recently as 1980, you'd likely identify yourself and your country with the Catholic Church without really thinking about it. And then everything changed. As quickly as the Irish became Catholic, they abandoned the church. From 1990 to 2000, the population in churches dropped as if a plague had swept across the land. Now, maybe 35% of the Irish identify themselves as church-going Catholic, even if 90% of them tick off the box marked Catholic on the census form. We stayed at St. Patrick's College, Maynooth, which is the only seminary in Ireland. As you walk through the college, you quickly notice something very singular. Every graduating class has a big picture with tiny little pictures of each one of the priests that are newly ordained in this giant picture. Now, if you look at the pictures from the 1920s and 30s, see a huge picture, and there's 100 or 150 little tiny pictures of eager young priests up there. And then the numbers start to decrease. By 1990, I don't know, 35 tiny little priests. And the ones that are most evident are the recent ones. 2012, 8 tiny little priests. 8. What happened? If you're Irish, you know. And if you followed recent church history, you probably have a pretty good idea. In 1996, the evidence became public that Irish bishops had been shielding a small number of child molesters from the arrest and imprisonment they so richly deserved. The number of offending priests was tiny, maybe 1% of the number of all the Irish priests, which just happens to be exactly the same number that you find in the general population. But the horrific effects of these cover-ups of almost 30 years led to hundreds of victims who had grown up as living, damaged people affected by this horrible sexual violence. When the government began to investigate, the evidence showed that the bishops had desperately tried to keep any mention of crimes from becoming public. At first, their concern was for a black eye for the individual diocese, but as the problem continued, even the archbishop began to fear for the reputation of the national church. And their fear was justified, In a flash, the Irish government divorced itself from the friendly relationship that it had with the Roman Catholic Church. The Tessék denounced the church publicly, and most recently it withdrew its embassy from the Vatican City. Now think about that. That's what you do when you're ready to go to war with somebody. The priesthood, which had once been the moral aristocracy of the nation, a vocation that was the highest that somebody could hope to achieve, was now universally regarded as morally bankrupt. The popular image of the priesthood was now the blundering clowns portrayed mockingly on what remains Ireland's probably most popular television show, Father Ted. It's difficult to imagine a more dramatic realization of Christ's warning from today's gospel. The people who had for so long been entrusted with putting their own needs above the needs of their charges and under the command of their master Christ, these bishops and priests had come to view their ministry not as a means to Christ's ends, but as an end in itself. The victims of the tiny number of evil priests, like the sparrows, are not uncounted, and their attackers and protectors have been brought down as having claimed allegiance to themselves rather than to Christ. What motivated the Irish bishops to betray their flock and ultimately to betray Christ? In most cases, it was not the belief that the priests they protected were innocent. No, it was the fear that the truth would jeopardize the greater mission of the church, which is the salvation of the faithful. Better, they reasoned, to permit the lesser evil to go unpunished than to make the greater evil possible. Behind their fear, then, was an inability to trust that their master could use them in the service of the truth, which is, after all, what Christ is. The message for us here is clear. If we think that we know what we're doing in realizing Christ's commands, but put aside the well-being of those for whom Christ died, the poor, the needy, we are deeply mistaken. It's easy enough to say that, but too often we allow circumstances that seem to us to be mitigating to appear to make the difference, to draw us from the kind of obedience that Christ demands of us. Of course, if I had been Bishop of Ferne, it would have been completely different. I'd never have made such an error, right? But that's exactly the reason for almost every sin. We suppose that we know better, and we elect ourselves for mastery. So how to avoid this tendency to allow ourselves to function with logs in our own eyes while casting about looking for motes in other people's eyes? I think the answer lies in the nature of the beast that we comprise as a group, the church, the body of Christ. As an Anglican, I want to say that the Irish Church's emphasis on the hierarchy was a big part of the problem. But no, that's short-sighted. Every single church makes these mistakes. Failure of the Christian endeavor lies not in the problems with organization, but in an inability to submit the self to the mastery of a force that surpasses anything that human beings can even imagine. What kind of a master is Christ? Let me tell you how the seminary at St. Patrick's has changed. When I was there, Cardinal Brady himself came for the annual graduation address to the dozen or so graduates. The topic of his brief homily was not retrenching, defending the status quo, or explaining away human weakness. Nope, it was reconciliation. The need the church has for humble submission to the mastery of Christ and publicly to express remorse and bitter regret. He made no promises, and publicly said, this is going to take more than our own lifetimes. He proclaimed no rosy future for the renaissance of Catholicism in Ireland. It was the first time I'd ever heard a cardinal speak, and I got to tell you, boy, was I ever surprised. It's just not cardinal language. Christ's mastery, though, is not in Cardinal Brady's call for humility, nor is it in the seminary's historically unprecedented emphasis on the call for a priest to be a servant in Christian leadership. Christ's mastery manifests itself in the Irish people's rage at a betrayed trust, at the hypocrisy of teaching Christian morality while behaving selfishly. And turning away from the church as it did, the Irish people manifested the fundamental Christian ideal of rejecting hypocrisy, even at the expense of turning away from a tradition that had defined their souls for centuries. This is Christ's mastery. We as human beings will realize his commands, even without intending to do so, by dying to who we are. Sometimes this particular passage in Matthew is described as being one of the difficult sayings of Jesus. But I don't think it is. He comes to set us against one another when we act through anger or fear or hatred. The sword that he brings, it will draw blood and it will cause pain. But it's wielded not as a weapon, but as a scalpel to save the human soul from itself. Remember this. While God so loved us that he gave his Son to die for us, the body of Christ in which we participate does not exist for us. Christianity is not about us, nor is it for us. We are for it. That's the force of the gospel today. Christianity and the Christian church are not here for us. We are made for Christ and to nourish the church. Therefore, who seeks to save his life will indeed lose it. But those who lose their life for Christ's sake will save it.